Welcome to Women for Election and our podcast today, where we'll be hearing Lynn Rowan chatting with Alison O'Connor. Lynn's going to talk about class, oppression, the impact of class on your life, and how it'll take you through your work as well. She talks about her book, People Like Me, and also the real importance of Women for Election and the work we do. As always, you'll find this wherever you find your podcasts. You'll find us on social media platforms, and if at all, you can donate on womenforelection.ie. Unfortunately, technology failed us a little bit on this one, and we didn't record the full session. When we join Lynn and Alison, Lynn is chatting about class and the impact of class and how it can affect your life.
And maybe with some of our politicians, they do feel that it's the choices they made and the hard work that they put in that got them where they are. Mm. And, you know, the Taoiseach, I think, in that debate with me, or in a separate one with me in the chamber, he referred to free will. And he referred to two brothers growing up in the one house. And one brother goes this way and one brother goes that way. And that's how simple the analysis was in his head. And I had given a really...
That's like parable type vibe.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but basically what that removes is individuals' experiences to life, because of course people in the same household, they have different perspectives, they have different experiences, they have different sensitivities, they have different skills, and they engage with the world differently. So trying to just bring two brothers in one house to explain the layers and layers and layers of oppression and class that can exist within a community, it's like that's literally the simplicity of your argument. And that's worrying, I think.
That's scary. Did that scare you, that that was the level of sort of empathy and understanding?
Yeah, like I'd say it was just a lack of analysis. And for me, I like to think that, for me, I like to give some leeway and just think that he the way we all exist within bubbles, that I think, you know, his bubble has been so... particular for a long time, that he just hasn't had enough experiences outside his own understanding and realm of life. And I feel he has obviously the capacity to learn and grow, but he has to listen. And unfortunately, when you're in politics, the first thing you don't really do is actually listen and engage and have real dialogue. So like as a philosophy student, I'm obsessed, as a philosophy graduate, I'm obsessed with dialogue and how dialogue looks. So dialogue is supposed to be a conversation between two people where it's not just an opinion or a struggle of opinions, you know, where sometimes I think politics has just become a struggle of opinions, where you finish saying your thing, but I just want to hurry up and get my thing in to try and completely dismiss what you're saying. Instead of having real true dialogue that allows us to actually get to unearth what the actual issues are, what the solutions are, how can we address this? But the ideology and the struggle of opinions completely dilutes any real positive dialogue that can happen between opposing, I suppose. Sure.
But clearly, Lynn, if you were just that little bit more resilient, you know, you could pass this.
Well, I swap my resilience for privilege. We'll see how quick they want to. So, yeah, like with resilience, I think for me, I've been kind of grappling with the word resilience for a few years in my head. And I've been really kind of working it out in a very live way in when I'm speaking on a stage or with a group. And for me... I read actually a feminist philosophical ecological paper a few weeks ago, and there was a word used in it in terms of ecology, and it just straight away clicked in with me with what I was trying to understand in terms of resilience. Completely different things, but it just sparked my thought process. So resilience, and they talked about manufactured resilience, and I'm like, that's what I'm talking about. But they were talking about it in an ecological sense. But if you take that, and I'm like, society and politics is trying to manufacture a resilience in people rather than address structural violence and inequality.
Because it's resilience after the fact.
Yeah. So resilience to put up with stuff that you shouldn't actually have to put up with. And that's not resilience at all. Like resilience is a thing that you bounce back from. Yeah. So if you're focused on building our communities to be resilient, we're not bouncing back. We're just getting more poor off and more tragedy and more death and more mental health. So actually, we're not bouncing back from that. That's not us being resilient. that's you convincing yourself that we're great for putting up with consistent trauma and pain, that actually, if it's not proportionally felt across the whole country, well, then it's unnatural and it's actually manufactured, and it's manufactured resilience. And that's completely different to the resilience that we would display, say, if our pet dies, or if we had a tragedy within the house, or just the things that happen to everybody. That's where we show resilience. The rest of the stuff is forced on us.
So do you think that that word should just be taken out of that discussion, that it's almost like a sort of a fig leaf?
No, I think, like I said on the last point around real dialogue, I think we need to be able to unpack language. And I think we need to be able to go, well, what does the use of this word actually mean? And what is a resilient community? Like, what is that? I don't think they know what it is when they're saying it. Like, if you were to actually engage, like, there's so many research reports now, building resilience in classrooms, instead let's address the inequality that has resulted in the fact that all these young people are experiencing suicide ideation. But it sounds more flowery to say, let's build resilience in the classroom, you know?
You mentioned before we started that you're involved in philosophy in the community. So would you consider that something that's helping to build resilience? And you might tell us a bit about what it is. It sounds really interesting.
Yeah. So about a year ago, Rob Grant, who is a TCD, has a doctor from TCD in philosophy and was tutoring there, contacted me to see how he could get involved in doing philosophy in the community. And myself, him, and I brought John Bissett in, who has always wanted to do this. He was a community worker from Dolphin House in Rialto. And we developed the program. So it's in its second year now. And now we have three classes. So there's people in recovery, there's youth workers, community workers, there's people that have grown up in Dolphin House their entire life, who have been engaging with the big philosophical questions their whole lives. They've had to be resourceful their whole lives. They've had to use reason and logic to get from the start of the day to the end of the day. But they've never had the frame on which to understand the actual depth of their intellect and how they're actually engaging with the material that they do every day. So the philosophy in the community is, we're exploring freedom, we're exploring Plato, we're looking at these big phrases like that we use so often on each other, like, you get what you deserve, you know? So really unpacking that, like resilience, how do you unpack that? Do you get what you deserve? You know, what does that mean? And, you know,
why that phrase in particular, Lynn?
Because, well, that was just one week, but I think it's just like these throwaway phrases, like, what comes around goes around, you know, like, so we're taking language, we're looking at language, we're looking at freedom, we're looking at morality, we're looking at whether humans can really progress and escape their own reality to be able to understand different perspectives and point of views. So we're looking at all the big, huge philosophical questions, but they're using their own experience of life to be able to connect with those, where they didn't know that that's what they were doing. They didn't know they were engaging in the big philosophical questions. And now they're making that thread. And I think the ability to be able to teach critical thinking to any community will benefit everyone. And I think politicians, especially, if we're able to engage in critical thinking, would be a win.
One of the this is a slightly different subject matter, but something, I mean, one of the big themes of lockdown, and this isn't on a lighter note, has been, I don't know whether you watched it, Normal People. You know,
I watched the first two. I did read the book, but I watched the first two.
What I'm wondering is, lots of people who've been to Trinity said that it reflected their experience, or reminded them of their time at Trinity. I'm wondering how that was for you.
No, my experience in Trinity, I suppose, was quite unique in the sense I was a mother, I was looking after my dad was ill. I didn't get to engage in Trinity life in that way, you know.
I did expect that would be your answer, but I guess it's to expand, you know, on that every experience.
I did read the book though, which was extremely enjoyable, and I really liked it. But when I seen all the commotion on Liveline, I suppose, and it made me a little bit frightened, because I've been writing some screenplays, and one of them is on teenage sex lives in the 90s, and it's quite quite gritty and it might be quite shocking for some. So when I seen the little bit of outrage, I was like, oh, they're not ready. They're not ready for me. They're not ready for this one.
When and where are we going to see the screenplays?
Well, I'm working with some producers and directors at the minute to try and make it happen. Like, so we're still in the very early process, but the story is written and the characters are in process. But it's very based on real lived experiences that obviously I fictionalized at some point. But the overall message is obviously consent, but it gives a real kind of... I watched a film the other night called Kids. It was made in 1995, an American film. Quite uncomfortable watch, but worth a watch, and it kind of resembles that a little bit, which is
what value do you think there is in the explicitness and the grittiness?
Well, it's kind of given a real and honest insight into how young people, when I was growing up, engaged with each other around sex. It's where they learned. It's full of myths, it's full of, you know, stuff that's just not factual. You see the lack of positive sex positive conversations.
Can you remember one of the myths offhand? What sort of thing you're talking about?
So like stuff around, like, you know, say convincing somebody to have, like, young girls thinking that you can't get pregnant on your first time, or yeah, you know, there's all these teenage conversations happening, and I suppose it's in its very early stages, but the hope for me is to just really, really shine a light on why we need open and honest conversations around sex in schools and homes, and for it to be sex positive, because we've always had a very negative relationship with how we teach young people about sex. It's usually you'll catch a disease, you'll get pregnant. There's never any sort of framing on it that leaves the child or the young person or the teenager feeling that sex might be something that they can be empowered by and to engage in an active way, and to be able to make the decision from a very informed and good place rather than making it from a place that feels like guilt and shame and is full of untruth.
Is it right to think, I mean, even the fact that normal people was on our screens in the first place, is it right to think that has improved in the last couple of years, the whole debate around consent, the level of knowledge? Do you think it has?
I think it has. I mean, when I first wrote the first article on consent, when I was in, it was around 2015, in a response to an article that was written about the consent workshops in Trinity. And I had never really spoke openly, or I'd never attempted to write my words. And maybe it was too reactive what I wrote, but I was just trying to be honest in the piece about consent and about the grey areas and about how consent is not just, you know, the obvious things that we think of. And I tried to tackle it for the first time. And I was in bed for about 3 days. I was attacked so badly online. I was called every name under the sun, a tramp, where's her parents? She was dragged up. There was just this absolute awful. And at that time, I was so new to a public platform. Now I don't read comments under things, but I kept getting tagged on Facebook by people that were trying to take up for me. And it was really devastating. And it really frightened me to ever talk about consent and talk about sex in that way. It took me about a year to kind of just heal from that. And then it was writing the book that allowed me to explore it and become really comfortable then. And when I talked about my sexual assault, say, within the book and on Ray Darcy, I've moved more into a place where I'm not as affected by the backlash, because I feel a bit more secure and understand, I suppose, consent in a much deeper way myself, which helps me. But also the conversations are happening so much more in that short space of time.
I'm trying to find a quote here that you said that somebody, that it's, oh yeah, you're only, I mean, in terms of sharing that sort of stuff on social media and very personal stuff on social media, which you'd continue to do. And it's somebody who said to you, you're only as sick as your secrets. But what about this idea that women politicians anyway are more open to that sort of abuse, that for your own mental health, that maybe you'd be better off not doing it? What keeps you going in that?
Because I have this, it's like a compulsion. I suppose the way I can answer this is the way I used to answer it around allowing the media to label me in particular ways. So like headlines being young mother, teen mother, ex-drug user, and people used to say to me, why is that not bother you? And I was like, the way I had to frame it in my head so that I could be okay with it was, well, in my community, there is people who are struggling with addiction. There is people who are trying to raise their kids alone. There is people who their children are caught in criminality. So for me, I have to accept that when them labels go out, that somebody that might need to read it will read it because they identify with the label that's actually being put on me, and they go, and that there's some sort of engagement with that. And I think the same is the stuff around how I talk about my private life is because there's so many experiences that I've had in life and I didn't know everybody else was having them. So when I learned that by sharing some of my experiences and using my platform to get those experiences in out into a wider context, that even though the abuse comes at me and I've had to learn how to manage that, the other stuff that comes at me is so beautiful and amazing. And I don't think we can we talk about that enough. I mean, I get letter after letter from women around the country, from young girls around the country, who something I have said has instigated a thought process in their head that's taken them on a particular route in their own journey, and to be able to feel part of that collective with other women and with other working class people who can look at me and see a part of them reflected back, and me saying, I've done this too, and I've experienced this too, or this has happened to me too.
I'm gonna ask. There's a number of questions, Lynn, and we go. There's one interesting one on the actual, politics of getting elected. But that is it more difficult to get elected as an independent without a party machine behind you, even in terms of money or, having a group to go around and ask people to give you votes, as opposed to that it's just yourself. Or do you have a team?
I think maybe I might be in the bit of a privileged position that Trinity like independent representation. So because I'm in the Senate is supposed to be independent. It's not supposed to be party driven. It's not supposed to be constituency. It's supposed to be national. So for me, my independence is a benefit because I can stand on that platform and say that I am truly independently engaging with the legislation and the policy. But I think maybe for the Dáil and for parties, it might be actually even a little bit harder for some of the women, especially to get elected when they're actually part of a party, because there's so many men, say in Fianna Fáil, they all group together and vote on them on the councils in a particular way, and so I think it can be I think it just really, really depends. I think money obviously is an issue. Money is a massive issue. But even when you're in a party, the party machine is not always behind you. And, I've had to knock on doors with women who are part of parties and parties that I'm not a member of, I don't anything, but I've had to knock on doors with them because they got no support from the party machine. And actually, it was just, a poster on a lamppost.
You think that's because they were brought onto the ticket because of a quota scenario? And then just there's another question here that tags onto that. And it's, that question was from Emma. This is from Maggie Power saying, do you think that it should be 50-50 male and female as a basic given? So where do you think quotas, where would you like quota percentages at?
Yeah, like 50-50 is preferable, and that's the way it should be. I think some parties make up numbers by putting women on, but other parties are not. Other parties, they're not as supportive on the ground as you would think that they are. But I think the 50-50 should be a given, but I don't think we should ever ignore what that 50-50 should look like. So I'm completely agree with 50-50. But it's just what's behind that 50-50 that matters to me. Yeah,
in terms of what you were saying earlier. What if we didn't really talk that much about sort of COVID and where things are at, but, if there's was one or two things briefly that you would like to see, coming out of this or being kept or our chance to reshape things, do you have thoughts on that?
Like, it's hard because, you know, obviously, I think the fact that we basically have had a basic income is a positive thing for me. I think it's worth discussion. But, you know, them conversations are obviously changing already. Do you know what I mean? Oh, we can't do this forever. You know what I mean? So, you know, you can already see that that was only a temporary measure and it possibly hasn't created any sort of discussion and dialogue at the Department of Finance top level where they're going, actually, is this something we should address? You know, that there is that there is a payment that some people receive less for. Like, what really hurt me was there was a man up this way in Talla who was a cleaner and died of COVID-19. He was a cleaner in the hospital, died of COVID-19. You know, this low paid, underpaid, and do you know what? Not necessarily valued by the state either. And he obviously has lost his life. His family have obviously lost their loved one. And the fact that his job would be seen as so little that, you know, he would have to keep working obviously through COVID because he's in a hospital. But the payment, like the fact that they're saying that that payment of 350 is too much, where you have this man who has lost his life for, I imagine, a very, very, very low income. And he still got up every morning and went in there and made sure the hospital was clean. And now he's gone. And that type of, you know, that type of inequality is so, so stark, because other people might have had the choice to not continue to go to work if they were concerned for their health or for their age or for anything like that. But so many other people don't have the privilege to stay at home and to work from home. And, you know, so when you hear figures being thrown around, like there's people receiving 350, but, you know, there's and that's more than the minimum wage. Mm-hmm. That shouldn't be something that you're saying we need to lower the basic income that we're giving people. That should cause the alternative conversation. We're going, Jesus, we're really not paying people enough, you know?
Yeah. Somebody, Joanne Murphy here is wondering, saying, loving the chat so far, how can communities access the philosophy in the community course? Sounds brilliant and is a new way of looking at grassroots community work.
What was the start of the question?
So just basically wondering about accessing the philosophy in the community. You know, she's saying that it's a brilliant community initiative. And I'm trying to find it.
I see it now.
Yeah.
Right, so the philosophy in the community is very, it depends, I suppose, where you're living. It's very geared at a particular group. So it's across the Canal communities at the minute, which is Bluebell, Inchicore and Rialto. Right. And it's working with people at particular points in their life. It's just why they're split up into three different groups. So for us, then, philosophy in the community classes is about trying to build capacity within the communities to engage with the material, but also with the youth workers and community workers, for them to be able to introduce it then actually, you know, into their services. Yeah. So we are expanding the philosophy in the community all the time. Like, we've gone from 1 to 3. So it depends really where Joanne lives and is, and, you know, in terms of whether a group can be set up and run from there. Rob, that
so
runs.
What, so I suppose what would qualify you to be a facilitator?
Rob, if it was us, Rob would facilitate. Yeah. You know, so if there was interest from a group in a different community, well, then they would just have to contact myself. And if the group was there, so if there was...
How are you contacted? Do you have a...
Aroctus email. Yeah.
What's that, Lynn?
lynn.rowan@aroctus.ie. And if a person has a group that they feel would benefit from it, well, then we can have the conversations with Rob about Rob actually then facilitating it. And we do it in like eight week blocks.
And you know something I didn't ask you, I'm thinking, when you were in Trinity and you were President's Students Union of that, how did the idea of the Senate, who suggested that to you? How did it come into your mind?
I think Finn Morphy, who was the ENTS officer for us, we were on a bus going to, I think, like a congress or something. And I remember Finn was reading like The Economist or something. I remember looking, thinking, oh God, imagine having to read that paper. And because I was like, so much finance, it's not me forte. Or maybe it was the Financial Times. And I said, Finn, you should run in the Senate elections. He says, me? He says, you should be running in the Senate elections. And it just kind of grew from there. And then people kept suggesting it. And for me, it was a bit...
First reaction. What was your first reaction to the idea of you as a senator?
That I didn't even know there was such thing as the Shannon 6 years earlier. How could I be a I'd be a senator? So for me, it was like, I don't know enough. Maybe that I didn't know enough political history. Like I wouldn't have had a connection with the state. I wouldn't have had a connection with society outside of my own community. Do you know what I mean? I wouldn't have felt like an Irish citizen sometimes. Do you know what I mean? I didn't have that connection to the wider context of my own identity. So I kind of felt that maybe I don't know enough, that maybe I'm supposed to have this real all-Ireland view of things and understand the whole country and understand the, you know, what happened in the last 100 years. So they were actually the things that were holding me back more than anything else.
Well, I guess that's classic female. You looked at the job spec and thought, oh yeah, man, I'm, you know, there's 30% of that isn't me. I couldn't possibly do it.
Yeah.
Okay. So then, I mean, we'll finish on this. I mean, then that it's that can lots of women, I imagine, around the country are told, you'd be a great politician, go for the council, you know, go for the Dáil, go for the Shannon. And it's that leap in between, getting that confidence. If somebody says it to you that you say, yes, I want to, will you be on my team? What advice would you give for women considering politics or being encouraged to do it?
For me, I can only say what I done and if it resonates, because I haven't operated within a constituency or within a party or within the council, maybe, you know, it won't apply to everybody in terms of how they want to enter politics. But for me, whether it was the Students' Union or then in the Shannon, I didn't actually wait for the confidence to come. I was not confident the whole way through. I doubted myself. I also believed in myself. I think people think that we all exist in one pile or the other, but actually some days I really believed in myself, some other days I doubted myself, and it was allowing myself to freely move between all these feelings and emotions and still going, all I can do is put my message out. I don't need to focus on other people or other parties or what anybody else is saying. What am I saying? Am I saying it with conviction? Am I saying it based on my principles and my values? And if people align with that, then people align with that. And I had no election team, which is like in Trinity, it started off with me and Rob, who done TAP with me. And by the end of the week,
Trinity Access program. Yeah.
And by the end of the week, we had hundreds of people putting on the T-shirt because they liked what I was saying. And I focused on me and my personality and who I am. And then I done the same with the Shannon. It was just me and Seb, who was my manager. And we had to figure out everything for the first time. I was very lucky that Seb is a real political nerd. So he was able to get stuck into the stuff that I wouldn't be able to engage with. So the biggest thing I do is I know my deficits. I figure out what my deficits are. And then I let people help me who fill those deficits. And, you know, with that.
I suppose it's what you're saying. And I mean, it's something I come across so often, and my advice, what you're essentially saying about if there was a lack of confidence, you fake that till you make it. Just push through it.
Yeah, you know, and sometimes I go, your lack of confidence right now doesn't mean you're not able for the job. So lack of confidence doesn't mean that you're not going to be good at the job. So it's about trying to be able to separate these two things and say, yes, my esteem is not great here, or my confidence doesn't feel like it's good enough. But does one equal the other? Does that mean you're not going to be good at it? So if you can separate them two and go, yeah, I'm feeling shaky, I'm feeling nervous, I'm feeling doubtful, but that doesn't mean I'm not going to be good at the job. So just unpack.
And what about then, just to finally finish it then and positively, are there days where you think, you know what, today I am rocking it?
And they happen more and more and more and more. And you know what, most days I'm rocking it.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I hope everybody else enjoyed it. I really did myself. And thanks for all the questions.
Thank you both for that. That was brilliant. I mean, a conversation ranging across areas like critical thinking, sexual assault and rape, the importance of sharing experiences, class and class in politics, resilience and what that means, and more importantly, what it doesn't mean. And the programme for government, it was just fantastic. Thank you. For those of you who've joined us, a quick reminder around the programme for government, that Women for Election is asking for the next programme for government for a commitment to a 40% quota in the local elections, which we really, really need to see, along with proper funding for women for election. And also, and this is something that Lynn touched on in terms of the Taoiseach nominees to the next Seanad, that they need to be women. The imbalance in politics is such that we need women nominated to the Seanad to partly address some of the imbalance there. Thank you again, Lynn and Alison. That was just great. Thanks to all of you who joined us. And let's all keep in touch. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Huge thanks again to Lynn Rowan and Alison O'Connor for joining us today. As always, if you can spread the word on social media, please do so. If you can donate to Women for Election, please go onto our website, womenforelection.ie. And hopefully you'll join us for our next podcast, where we'll be hearing Alva Smith chatting with Alison O'Connor.